Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Thank you. many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry, because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land, okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with, usually, if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in. and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions. And that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills. And then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat. I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on-site. So Mr. Huss' supplier is only a bike ride away.
3,000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
因为现在市场已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。七点钟准时安排送量。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more.
好，先生，加油，砍切，小心，看，站好，好，好，好。Little
wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war.
好，先生，动作快一点，地板叫人扫一下，地板脏兮兮的都不会扫，先叫上来，先。后面快点。
By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on.
Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiamen, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
Initially,
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Li expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist.
Mm.
He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Yashin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 U.S. dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yuba's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yuba's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yuba has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yuba's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yuba must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yuba's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yuba's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yuba's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yuba's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yuba designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.
At the end of the first millennium, around 1000 AD, China was definitively the most powerful country in the world. More than a third of the world lived within its borders, its technology was the most advanced in existence, and its economy accounted for an astronomical 50% of the world's GDP. The West paled in comparison to China. But eventually, Europe arose from its dark ages, the importance of China diminished, and the West came to rule the world. Today that is still largely the case, but China is rising again. In 1978, China had a GDP of only $200 billion, only about 4% of the world's GDP. But nowadays, that GDP has risen to $11 trillion and accounts for 15% of all economic activity in the world. This economic renaissance of the last 40 years is largely thanks to one industry, manufacturing. We've come to accept that China is the world's factory, but it wasn't always this way. In the early 20th century, goods were often just produced right where they were sold. America made American goods, Europe made European goods. It wasn't until cheap worldwide shipping became available that the production side of a company could be relocated to the other side of the world. But why did China win? How did this country become the manufacturing giant it is today? In 1978, Deng Xiaoping took power in the People's Republic of China. He quickly visited Bangkok, Singapore, and other flourishing Asian cities and was convinced that, in order to succeed, China needed to open itself up to the outside world, at least to an extent. He gave people control of their farms, privatized business, and most importantly, allowed foreign investment in the country for the first time in decades. He opened up four special economic zones with tax incentives and exemption from the oversight that the rest of the country saw on its investments and trade activity. These four zones were essentially the free market portions of China. But none was more successful than this one, Shenzhen in the Guangdong province, so I went there to see what it was like. Before its designation as a special economic zone in 1980, Shenzhen was a tiny town with about 30,000 inhabitants. But today, that's grown to nearly 18 million people. That means that its size rivals that of New York and London. It's believed that Shenzhen might have been the single fastest growing city in human history. Every other special economic zone was an established area before its designation, but Shenzhen made sense as a spot where China could embrace the West as it lay just north of the border of Hong Kong, what was at the time a British territory. Today, Shenzhen is the electronics manufacturing capital of the world.
So Shenzhen as a city is really known for two things. One is its manufacturing capabilities, especially for consumer electronics products. And second, its gravitation for talents or human resources, especially on the product development and research and development disciplines.
Apple, Samsung, Microsoft, Sony, Canon, they all manufacture products here in Shenzhen. In fact, 90% of the world's electronics are made at least in part in this city. Everything just costs less in China, so labor costs less too. Where a factory in the United States might pay upwards of $10 to $15 an hour, a Chinese laborer would happily accept $3 or $4 an hour in Shenzhen. When I was there, I withdrew the equivalent of $80 from an ATM upon arrival and left 4 days later with cash left over. A 30-minute taxi ride cost about $7. A full meal at a local place was about $3. But China isn't cheap entirely naturally. China has artificially depressed the value of their currency. Up until 2005, the Chinese government just said that the exchange rate was 8.27 won per dollar, and that was that. They then went a few years allowing it to increase in value within a margin, but in 2008, they pegged its value again to make Chinese exports more attractive during the financial crisis. Nowadays, the government just picks an exchange rate daily and lets the currency fluctuate from it by up to 2%. This just makes it so Western companies can buy more for less. China also doesn't charge taxes on exports, while the US doesn't charge taxes on imports. The US doesn't even charge customs fees for some products like tablet PCs, so some products can make it all the way from their factory in China to stores in the US completely tax-free. When I was in Shenzhen, I visited a company called Anker. They make all sorts of consumer electronics, but chances are if you have something from them, it's one of their portable batteries. I asked their CEO why so many electronic companies are now based in Shenzhen.
So the advantage is that, you know, we're close to the supply chain, so everything is faster, right? So instead of like, you know, you do a mock-up and, you know, see it like 2 weeks later, here actually you send them, you know, designed mock-up and you receive it like 3 days later.
In Shenzhen, there are markets where you can buy every part imaginable. There are factories ready to build prototypes in a matter of days. There are engineers ready to work at a drop of a hat. Development just happens faster in Shenzhen. A U.S. company might use the same factories as one based in Shenzhen, but the geographical distance makes production slower. In addition, word travels fast in Shenzhen. A few years ago, Anker was first to market with a technology called Power IQ that allows for faster device charging. The engineers from Anker told me that a big reason they were able to go to market before the Western companies was because they heard about it first, thanks to the proximity to other engineers and companies. Shenzhen just produces things better and faster, but a product isn't just a physical item.
Honestly, being in Shenzhen for this company is an advantage for the supply chain that we can develop very good products with competitive price. But for the brand, it's also a kind of a challenge.
What Shenzhen can't build as well is brands. Certain companies like Anker have been able to an extent, thanks to smart PR and marketing, but some other companies just don't bother. Lucrative Western consumers want familiar and approachable feeling brands, but cultural differences and geographic distance often make Chinese-based companies just seem different. All across Shenzhen, I saw these boxes filled with rentable portable chargers, and as it turns out, it was an Anker product. But the Chinese-designed product didn't really succeed in the Western markets.
So actually, talking about Anker Box, the product is originally designed for the Western market. However, actually, our trial in Seattle wasn't that successful. So we realized, first of all, like, you know, U.S. people actually, when they go to a bar, they actually really go there drinking instead of looking at their phones. Well, if you go and walk into a bar in China, you'll find actually like 20 tables of people standing around looking at their phone.
When the designers are thousands of miles away from the consumer, they might not be as knowledgeable of their wants. Some companies have sprung up in Shenzhen whose whole business is to develop and produce products without a brand. They're called white label companies. They might produce earphones, for example, then sell them to a Western audio company who will attach their brand and sell the product at a markup. Despite its enormous role in increasing the GDP of China 30-fold in the last 30 years, manufacturing is not an entirely sustainable industry for the country long term. The problem is that, rather ironically, the economic growth that manufacturing spurred in China has increased labor prices to a point where their manufacturing is less competitive. Before manufacturing came in, China was a country of poor rural farmers. But today, China has a real middle class and cities that are expensive to live in. It used to be that workers like the ones at Anchor's factory moved to the city for a few years when they were young to make money for their family back home. But nowadays, people are moving to cities permanently and want to be able to set up solid middle-class urban lives. The average cost for real estate in central Shenzhen is almost $1,200 per square foot. That's even higher than San Francisco and New York. Even when workers live outside the city center, higher wages are necessary even just to pay for housing. At the same time, manufacturing is becoming less labor-intensive every day as robots and automation are becoming increasingly advanced and inexpensive. In 2015, China launched an initiative spending hundreds of billions of dollars each year to upgrade and automate factories to keep prices low. But this will likely do little to keep companies from packing up shop and moving elsewhere. Manufacturing lines that can be automated are likely to move back to the United States and the rest of the Western market. Robots cost the same whether they're in the United States or China, so manufacturing products in the U.S. helps save on shipping costs and certainly is good for PR. At the same time, the labor-intensive jobs that China prospered on in the past decades are moving to less developed and less expensive countries like Vietnam, Bangladesh, and India. Chinese manufacturing firms are responding to this by opening up their own factories all across the world, everywhere from Africa to the United States itself. The model that might work for China in the future is that of Anchor. Chinese-based firms that can take advantage of their proximity to the production lines to cut down on development cost and time. Shenzhen-based startups like Anchor, DJI, and OnePlus have already succeeded in taking advantage of this proximity, but more are being established each day. If you see a hardware-based Kickstarter campaign, there's a good chance it comes from Shenzhen. 10 years ago, a company would be hard-pressed to succeed in Shenzhen as its own brand because historically the retailer has acted as a barrier in between the manufacturer and consumer. But with the rise of Amazon and other e-commerce sites, it's now possible for Eastern companies to sell directly to the Western consumer in a system that rewards for quality over price. The time really is ripe for Chinese entrepreneurship. While Silicon Valley might be the dominant area for software startups, it's hard to rival Shenzhen as an ecosystem for hardware development and manufacturing. I have to give a huge thanks to Anchor for bringing me out to Shenzhen to research and film this video. It truly would not have been possible without them, and they gave me complete creative control over the video. I've actually owned and used an Anchor battery for over 5 years that's never broken down, even when it's been accidentally submerged twice and dropped countless times. But luckily, they upgraded me to one of their newest ones, which I love. The main thing I want to plug for them is their Power It Up contest going on right now. 10 winners will each get $2,000 in cash and a bunch of free Anchor products. To enter, you make a video up to 1 minute long about an unpleasant or awkward situation caused by running out of power, upload it to YouTube, then share it on their page, and the 10 highest voted ones at the end of the contest win. The link to enter is in the description, so good luck. Aside from that, please be sure to check out my podcast, Showmakers, and subscribe to this channel to get all my future videos right when they come out. Thanks again for watching, and I'll see you next week for another Wendover Productions video.
I don't think people necessarily understand what happened last week with the Great Make America Great Again hat. What are you trying to do with the message you're sending?
Well, it was really just my subconscious. It was a feeling I had. You know, like people were taught how to think. We're taught how to feel. We don't know how to think for ourselves. We don't know how to feel for ourselves. People say feel free, but they don't really want us to feel free. And I felt a freedom in, first of all, just doing something that everybody tells you not to do. I just love Trump. That's my boy. Like, you know, it's like so many rappers. You look at a video of Snoop Dogg loving Trump, but then he get in the office and now they don't love him. Like, Trump is one of rap's favorite people,
no,
right?
But we talk about this, that before he was elected president, people in hip-hop, it was an in thing to put Donald Trump in your rhyme somewhere.
Yeah. And by the way, I am in hip-hop, but I'm not just in hip-hop. I'm a black person in a black community, but I'm not just that. I feel like one thing is people try to minimize me to artists, hip-hop, black community. Yeah, I'm always going to represent that, but I also represent the world. When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all? You know, like, it's like we're mentally in prison. I like the word prison because slavery goes too direct to the idea of blacks. It's like slavery, Holocaust Jews, slavery is blacks. So prison is something that unites us as one race, blacks and whites being one race, that we're one, we're the human race. Do you feel that I'm feeling, do you feel that I'm being free and I'm thinking free?
I actually don't think you're thinking anything. I think what you're doing right now is actually the absence of thought. And the reason why I feel like that
is because Kanye, you're entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to believe whatever you want. But there is fact and real world, real life consequence behind everything that you just said. And while you are making music and being an artist and living the life that you've earned by being a genius, the rest of us in society have to deal with these threats to our lives. We have to deal with the marginalization that has come from the 400 years of slavery that you said for our people was a choice. Frankly, I'm disappointed, I'm appalled, and brother, I am unbelievably hurt by the fact that you have morphed into something, to me, that's not real. Bro, you gotta be responsible, man.
Bro, I'm sorry I hurt you.
You gotta be responsible.
No. I'm sorry I hurt you, bro.
Bro, your voice is too big.
Now, yesterday we talked about, and today's podcast is titled, What Do You Do When the Bank Says No? We're going to get to that momentarily. But yesterday we talked about, is victimization, is victimhood a mental illness? Now, in that last exchange with Kanye West and somebody who was working for TMZ, particularly the black dude from TMZ, who you heard him say it yourself, he says he feels incredibly hurt. Says he who has an internet connection, says he who works for TMZ, says he who has all these electronics, says he who's never experienced slavery, says he who probably, you know what, he might not have ever seen a cotton plant in his life, let alone pick one. But, well, who's mentally ill? The guy who says Kanye hurt him, or is Kanye mentally off balance? Because he does put a lot out, you know, depending on the day of the week. He does put a lot out there. All right, we're going to be back in a few. We can talk about that, any trending topic you want, or I'm going to get into briefly. I won't be long on it. The bank said no. Now what?
This is the Rumor Report with Angela Yee on the Breakfast Club.
So listen up.
Well, according to reports, because you know it's about their time when people are submitting their numbers to Forbes, Kanye is worth more than $6 billion. I believe they have the number at $6.6 billion. Now, Bloomberg reports the collaboration between Yeezy and Gap is expected to arrive in stores later this year, and that could be valued as high as $970 million. Yeezy is currently valued at $3.2 billion to $4.7 billion. Now, I have these official numbers that were submitted, and I'm going to tell you what these assets are and the valuation of Yeezy for Adidas is $3.7 billion. The valuation of Gap Yeezy is $1.6 billion. The valuation of YeezySupply.com is $1.5 billion. He has $123 million in cash and stocks, $100 million in Skims investment, $68 million in buildings and improvements, $48 million worth of land, $10 million worth of artwork, $7 million worth of jewelry, $5 million in cars, $3 million in machinery and equipment, and $1.1 million worth of livestock, which includes sheep, horses, etc.
Okay.
Yeah, his ranch is amazing. Listen, LLC Twitter, do you realize why partnerships are important now?
Does Kanye get to that $6 billion net worth without receiving a royalty around 15% of Yeezy revenue from Adidas? He got equity and royalties in his Gap partnership as well. But to LLC Twitter and everyone who got their business degrees from YouTube University, this is why partnerships are important. This is how you get your company to scale fast and get the kind of capital that Kanye currently has, but keep being happy owning 100% of nothing.
So he has his evaluation at $7.16 billion. Now, despite partnering with Adidas for the Yeezy brand, Kanye does retain complete ownership and control. He signed a 10-year agreement to design and sell clothes under the Yeezy Gap label last year, although the deal does exclude footwear, and the current Yeezy partnership that he has with Adidas lasts until 2026.
Hey, man, you know, keep growing your companies to scale.
Absolutely.
You know, keep growing that capital to make all those investments. All those investments you named from the livestock and everything else, that's because he's got the capital to do it, because he's using that capital from these partnerships that he's doing. But keep being happy owning 100% of nothing.
Stop it. Now, you know, when people talk all this, I got 100%. 100% of nothing is nothing.
100% of nothing is nothing.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's also good to be diverse, too. And you see he has a wide, very, very portfolio. Artwork, jewelry, cars, sheep, horses, land, buildings.
Absolutely. But that's what you can do, and you act like, as Emmy was just saying, you get 15% of this over here, 20% of this over here, and you use that capital to make those investments and diversify your portfolio.
All right, now, good news for Boosie. He is officially cancer-free. If you guys remember, he was asking his fans to pray for him when he went to his annual checkup.
Annual cancer checkup. I come every year. Y'all say a prayer for me. I already said 100 prayers. I'm still going to be cancer-free.
I love it.
Then a few hours later, he posted, "I'm cancer-free. Tears of joy. Thanks to everybody who said a prayer for me. God is great."
I love it. Black people building capital. Black people beating cancer. I love it. Give me one more, Yee. Come on. Give us something good.
All right. Let me skip that one.
No, what was it? What was it?
DJ Drama was on Drink Champs.
Okay.
And it got a little awkward. Nori basically put out this teaser, and here is, according to Nori, it seems like he's giving some motives, I guess, into this Drake and Drama situation. Listen to this.
Drake smashed your girl.
Jesus.
Well, which other way I'm supposed to say it?
Drake had sexual relations
with a girl that was affiliated with you. All of a sudden, Meek, Philadelphia artist, winds up in Mean Street Studio, and he hears this reference of these other songs, discrepancies. What's my man name? He ain't been around since.
Quentin Miller.
Now, all roads led to DJ Drama at that time.
I can't wait till that full story gets told one day.
Mm-hmm. You know, we asked him about that when Drake threw in the line. Remember when he was up there, and I was like...
When Drama said last summer, I had Drama Girl,
not right now. Yeah.
Drake's a demon. He's evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but... but, yeah.
And you know they're reporting that Drake is trying to slide into those DMs for Kim Kardashian right now. Oh, well, he has a number, I'm sure, but...
He's a demon. But I can't wait till they tell that full story. But it's only four people that can tell that story fully, though. It would have to be Meek, Drake, Drama, and Quentin Miller.
You don't think Lake Sheezy and Don Cannon either?
Nah, those four in particular, specifically, would have to be the ones to tell that full story.
And listen, I got to slide this one in here, too, since you guys were talking about mixtapes and Versus is coming up this weekend. There was some random podcast.
Oh, hell no.
That,
who's that voice? Go ahead, continue.
And listen to this. Potentially, I guess, DJ Drama was talking about perhaps a Versus battle.
Would you be down to do it if you got tapped?
I'm going to say this. Like, when it comes to mixtape catalog, and there's a lot of legends out here.
Yep.
Pay my respect to everybody that came before me and then came after me. Nobody wants to see me.
Wow.
Come to mixtape catalog. I guarantee it. They can talk all they want. Yep. Nobody's fucking with me when it comes to mixtape catalog. If we're just talking about shit off the mixtapes,
yeah,
I will murder anybody.
Wow, that's a bold. You have no fear whatsoever. Anybody,
man, give me all the smoke.
Some people are throwing out Clue might be a good match for you.
Man, Clue is. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Clue.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Clue is like the OG. You know what I'm saying? If he's Dr. J, I'm Jordan, or if he's Jordan, I'm Kobe. But Nobody wants smoke with my catalog, bro.
Man, salute the drama for being so humble to give that to a fan. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, talking so disrespectful.
To be randomly talking to a fan and just tell a fan, you know, something like that. Yeah, I thought
drama said he was leaving the station and there was a guy outside with a recorder
up,
and he just felt bad for him.
So. That was my damn show. You guys just showed some respect.
That was you outside with the recorder.
Oh, you know what? Drama was saying something like somebody tried to steal his name and then people were mistaking this other person Dramos for him.
Yeah. I saw drama leave that in my comments too. He told Swiss and Tim to set up the verses. So
they can do it. Let's do it.
They should do it.
I think Clue got it.
Clue and drama versus would be great. Straight mixtapes, though.
All right. Well, that's your rumor report.
That's mixtape albums, though.
Nope. Just the mixtape.
You can't do that.
Nope.
You can't do that. You can't do that.
The freestyles and the exclusive songs.
Clue still got it, but you can't do that. You got to be able to play the Rough Riders remix and all that stuff that Clue produced and Clue did, and that's on his album.
I'm sure he had that on his mixtape.
All right. We can debate later, guys.
Yes, we can.
All right.
All right, well, it's 12 noon here in my neck of the woods, Eastern Standard Time. All right, today we're going to do this real quick, and then we'll do an expanded version here, and then we're going to have set up some offline event for you. What do you do when the bank says no, or the bank said no, now what? There is, what the hell? There's a board game that if you haven't heard of it, it's a business board game. It's fun for people of all ages and educational backgrounds. Board game's called Cashflow, invented by this guy, Robert Kiyosaki, who's written several books, Rich Dad series books. I don't want to go into detail now, but what I want you to do is go. Let me see. I'm on my phone here. Cashflow. You need to. It's like Monopoly on steroids. They have Cashflow 101 board game, and Cashflow 202. Now the 202 board game is for people that are interested in stocks and things of that nature. The Cashflow 101 game, which is the basic fundamental game, is geared towards business and entrepreneurship. I recommend starting off playing Cashflow 101. Now, I want to see if they have an online version, because this has a whole lot to do with the bank said no, now what? If you're in need of, you owe some money, back rent, back mortgage payments, back whatever. Large, you owe like $5,000, $10,000, $50,000, $100,000. What can you do when the bank says no, they won't help you out? Or, it can be a personal loan. You need to start doing small deals. In the board game, Cashflow, I'll tell you this much. They're cards that you pick, and two of the card categories that you can choose from are big deals and small deals. All right? I've played that game at least 300 times. I've got some distinctions on there, too, but let's start off with how he has the game set up, big deals and small deals. When the bank says no, you need to start getting into small business transactions that are not going to break the bank, and then constantly trade those. And this is, I'm talking about in real life, but the board game allows you to practice for real life situations. But, and this is something visual we're going to have to do because we can only do so much in this format. I believe, you know what, put in cash flow game or play cash flow online. Oh, you know, here it is. Cash flow classic. Type in any search engine. Play cash flow classic online. Do that. All right, do that. And then, man, if we get a couple of you on here, that we can walk you through this. How you can take a board game or so, you, no matter what kind of financial situation you might be in. All right, we're going to end it for today because I've had a busy morning even before we came on. Matter of fact, this show was originally scheduled for 4:30 today, but I had a court date by remote, got through that successfully, and hey, enjoy your day. Talk to you guys tomorrow.